Donald's minding his own business when a SWAT team swarms, wraps him up, throws him in the back of a cell. A man approaches.
You're being charged with possession of explosives, which is against Danish law number such and such and such. You're being charged with terrorism.
You're a terrorist.
I'm a terrorist. And I lost it. I just kept repeating the same thing. No way. No way. Impossible. Impossible.
Terrorist.
Al-Qaeda.
We've detected explosives.
Now it occurs to me that this is serious and it's dangerous and it's scary.
What is snap judgment? It's that left, that right. Jump. Jump. Or don't. Snap judgment? Storytelling with the beat from NPR. Stay tuned.
Sorry. Come on in.
Get real close, because you're listening to Snap Judgment, the podcast.
Snap Judgment Podcast. Snap Judgment Podcast from NPR.
Welcome to Snap Judgment from NPR and PRX. I'm your host, Glenn Washington, coming at you from beautiful downtown sunny Oakland, California. That's DJ Smooth Grooves on the ones and twos. Gimme, 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 gimme. Now today, this is a sick day. Not love sick. Today on Snap Judgment, we get homesick. Today we're going to feature a raft of stories from people who want to get home to that safe place they remember. The fates conspire against them. First up, a tale from back in the early days of our war on terror. Snap Judgment. Our friend Mohammed Baghdadi was born in Syria. He's a Muslim. He lives in Arizona and is married to an American woman named Susan. And Mohammed is about to take off on a Scandinavian business trip when he notices something.
I couldn't find my green card.
You couldn't find it?
I couldn't find it.
So you canceled the trip and decided not to go to Scandinavia?
I didn't. That was my big mistake.
You didn't cancel. You got on the airplane.
I did. I'd heard of friends who they lost their green cards while traveling, and they were able to get back.
Friends named Charlie or Stan, but your name is not Charlie or Stan.
Charlie or Stan don't have green cards.
So you got on the airplane.
Right.
Mohammed is in Denmark, and he puts the paperwork through for a new green card at the American Embassy. So everything's going to be cool, right?
I was done with business. It was my last evening. I'm coming home the next day, Valentine's Day, February 14, 2003. I was walking down the street, and I happened to be walking out of a big yellow tent, a Scientology tent, because they were giving these free Reiki massage things. I forgot to get a free massage. And all of a sudden I feel my arms pulled behind my back, and I look around, and there's maybe 15, 20, I don't know, super trooper, Star Wars looking, you know, big black Velcro vests, anti-terror SWAT team. The first thing I thought, is Scientology illegal in Denmark? I didn't do anything wrong, there's no way. Is this some big scam? They tell me in Danish, they're the police, and I'm under arrest.
Do you speak Danish?
No.
Do you know what they're saying to you?
I figured it out. So they take me to the police station. What's interesting, I'm surprisingly calm.
They're surrounding you, though.
Yeah, they're surrounding me all around, and they proceed to ask for my clothes. And they're telling me to take my shoes off, my belt off, and they're all standing around me, being really mean. I mean, they're being really intimidating. They're treating me with aggression like I'm a criminal.
You're a dog.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a dog. That's right. I'm an animal. They shove me into a cell, and then they strip search me. I take all my clothes off, completely naked. They check me, bend over.
They have to check your buttocks.
Right. Spread and check.
Just a few hours before, you're this urban, sophisticated businessman.
Right.
Maybe going to buy a little something for his wife on the way back home.
Valentine's Day gift, right. Door shuts, it's a heavy metal door, they lock it, and they walk away. And then I'm looking at the cell, and I'm just thinking, I could be here. Who knows for how long?
No one knows you're there.
No one knows I'm here. Have I been here an hour? Have I been here 3 hours? I have no idea how long I've been here. lie down. It's getting cold in here. I put this little blanket over me and these two blankets over me, and then it occurs to me, I remember seeing a movie or hearing something sometime that the guilty prisoners are the ones that sleep comfortably, and the innocent ones are so distraught about where they are and what's happening, they don't sleep. So I can't sleep. Sit back up and your mind just starts messing with you.
You're questioning yourself.
You start to question yourself. What have I done? Did I do whatever it is they're going to tell me I did that I don't know that I did?
After they leave at that point, when does someone come back for you?
They come back, what I think is a couple hours later, put me in a room, and there was two detectives, man and a woman, and a translator. He starts, "You know why you're here?" And I said, "I don't know why I'm here." And he says, "Okay, I'll tell you. You were at the U.S. Embassy earlier. You set off an alarm, you remember?" I said, "That's right." And he said, "What happened?" And I said, "Well, my laptop apparently set it off." I said, "They asked me if I work with chemicals, explosives." "I work with books, man. I work with software, pure and simple, nothing." He said, "Okay. Well, we've been informed by the U.S. Embassy that they found a very rare and hard to find explosive residue called TATP, which is commonly used by Middle Eastern suicide bombers."
"No, they didn't."
"On your laptop."
"No, they didn't find that on your laptop."
"Hold on." And then he said, "And therefore, you're being charged with possession of explosives, which is against Danish law number such and such and such. You're being charged with terrorism."
"You're a terrorist."
"I'm a terrorist." And I lost it. And I couldn't stay. So I just said, I kept saying, "No way. No way. No way. No way. No way, bullshit. I just kept repeating the same thing. "No way, no way, impossible, impossible. There's nothing on my laptop. Test it again. Where'd they test it? Test it again. Test it 100 times. Test it again. There's no way."
"You know they disappear people who have explosive residue on them."
"Right. Now it occurs to me that this is serious and it's dangerous and it's scary. Travel too much, Syrian passport, all over the world, Muslim clearly, and that brought up a lot of questions.
The test was, what's his name again?"
"Right, Mohammed first name, Baghdadi last name, the U.S. is about to go into war, into Iraq." My timing was really bad.
"Mohammed Saddam Hussein, Al-Qaeda, Baghdadi."
"Bin Laden, Baghdadi." "Bin Baghdadi, how's that?"
"The Danish think that you..."
"They thought I was..."
"...might blow somebody up."
"You're right."
"And they're going to stop it."
"Right."
"What did they do next?"
"You throw the most extreme surprise at someone and see how they react. And if we're right, we got him. If we're wrong, what's the big deal?"
No harm done.
He questions me for about an hour and a half about my background. Do I go to Arabic schools, Muslim schools, madrasas, military training camps?
And you're telling them the truth.
Right.
How are they reacting to it?
I started to see that they were treating me with a little bit more humanity or more respect. You know? And then at some point, I don't remember why they both left. And now they came back with a cup of coffee for me and some toast with Nutella.
First thing they had brought you to?
First thing. Drink? Yeah, first thing. So now they had seen that thing started to change.
A little Nutella on there.
Yeah, one had Nutella, one had jam, I think it was.
Tastes good.
Yeah, it tastes great. Now, out of the blue, he said, "Okay, everything you've told us is true. We know that because we've checked everything you've said prior to this question and answer. They went to my hotel room, they got all my belongings, and we've checked your computer, and we can't find anything."
"So?
So
let me go. I'll see you later.
All charges are dropped and you'll be released." And then I got a little bit indignant. I got a little bit sarcastic. And I said, "Oh, you couldn't find anything. Oh, I just disappeared." And I went, poof, just like that. The most explosive, dangerous explosive in the world. Suicide Middle Eastern suicide bomber. And now, poof, it's gone.
You're messing with him.
I'm messing with him.
You're a little irate.
I should be irate. But then again, I got to check myself and say, I'm still a Syrian citizen.
And you're still in their custody.
Right. And he says, I don't know. It could be some soap. It could be. I said, soap? Soap did this? So he says, please accept my apologies. That you're a businessman traveling in our country. This is no way to treat a businessman.
You got an official apology from the government?
I did. I got an official habit, and I got an official apology, and they paid me.
They paid you what?
$700.
Muhammad gets on a plane and leaves Copenhagen. He thinks he's fine. But then, again, he's detained in Amsterdam doing a layover. He's questioned for 8 hours before he's finally released. He starts to think, wait a minute, am I on some kind of list? Finally, he touches down in America.
I walk off the plane, and as soon as I get off into the gate, and a cop comes up and says, get off the phone, get off the phone, get off the phone right now. FBI is waiting for me.
FBI. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the FBI is paying Muhammad's wife, Susan, a visit.
There came a knock at the door, and it's the FBI.
At this point, is there even a shadow of a doubt that perhaps Muhammad has a second identity that you don't know anything about?
You sound like the FBI.
Susan, how well do you know this man?
I know him really well.
So you have no doubt in your mind that there's been a horrible mistake made?
No doubt. My only real fear was that they were not going to let him go, that they were going to take him from the airport and incarcerate him and hold him indefinitely.
Things are not okay. Muhammad is once again seized, stripped, and interrogated.
It's round and around and around. It's good, and that's good cop, bad cop. That really, and they manipulate you, and it works, and you know you're being manipulated, and it still works. They focused on the green card.
You didn't tell them that you had lost it beforehand.
No.
You told them you lost it
on the trip. Who could you have given it to? I couldn't have given it to anyone.
Your cousin. Your buddy.
Someone.
Your schoolmate.
And finally,
it magic? Did the green card just disappear? Where's the green card?
They were pissed off about it. And finally, they sort of, in the corner, pushed me in the corner. Okay, all right. I lost it before I left. I didn't lose it on the trip. I had to stick with my story.
You lied to the FBI, and they caught you lying. What else did you lie about?
So then they said it would really look good for me if I would take a polygraph test.
They hook you up to a lie detector?
Yeah, I took it. Have you ever cheated? Did you ever cheat in school? If I say no, I'm lying. And if I say yes, I'm a cheater. And she said, just say the truth. We have no opinions. It's about lying. So I said, did you ever cheat at school? Yes. Do you wish to harm this country? And I said, no. And she said, let's ask that one again. Do you wish to harm this country? And I said, no. And she said, you're lying. I said, I'm not.
She said you're lying.
Yeah. And I said, I'm not lying. And she said, you're not telling me the truth because it shows you. I said, I'm not lying. She said, just calm. Let's stay calm and tell because it's showing up.
Stay calm.
And I said, you know what? I'm done. You said I can leave. She goes, no, we're not done yet. I said, no. You said I could be done whenever I wanted to. I'm done. I'm hallucinating. I'm seeing patterns on this wall. I've been up for 3 days. I'm done. And I was done.
Finally, Muhammad is released by the American authorities.
Muhammad, so what would you recommend to anyone who decides to leave the country without a green card?
Don't go to Denmark. No, that's not true. I would say if anywhere, go to Denmark. I would say don't do it. And if you're gonna, you have to do it. Consider what's happening in world affairs. Who's protesting where, what wars are being fought, what your nationality is, what your religion is, what your name is. But I would highly recommend against it.
Don't do it if your name is Muhammad.
Al-Baghdadi. With Syrian passport. Don't do it.
Snap judgment.
Good news, Muhammad. We found your green card. It was right next to your AK-47 and your detonation device. Please stay away from them Al-Qaeda type. Snap judgment from NPR and PRX. Stay tuned.
To learn more about the stories and featured storytellers that you are hearing on Snap Judgment, visit our website at snapjudgment.org. Once there, you can browse through links and view photographs and videos relating to these pieces. You are listening to Snap Judgment from NPR.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from NPR and PRX. It has been said that you can't go home again. But for real, what if you really, really can't go home? Armed guards, barbed wire, suspicious-looking hooded agents outside your crib. Oh, no, that's not my house. I got to go this way now. Today on Snap Judgment, when you really can't go home again.
Hey, so what time is the Dodgers game?
7.
I brought my powder blue little booties with my ripped jeans and my blue handbag so that I show some support to the Dodger team.
Those are Dodger blue boots.
I'm subtle. It's impossible to not feel the LA pride here. You know what I mean?
What does LA mean to you?
LA means diversity and keeping an open mind. My name is Victoria Crooks. We are on our way to have some amazing dinner with my family, my house. My sister's preparing to go to Bolivia, and I'm her personal stylist. We're going to talk about last-minute preparations and what little gifts she's taking to our family out there. Okay, perfect.
Okay, let's go.
Hey, Rita, open the door. Okay. Hi, Daddy. It's cold in Bolivia, so the main thing she's going to wear are leggings, skinny jeans, jeggings.
Jeggings?
Yes.
What are jeggings?
Jeggings are leggings, but denim fabric. So she's going to wear that. But the outfits and the looks, we always do that. Every trip that she goes to, we always do it.
We always fight.
No.
Home place, Potosí. So my family and I came from Bolivia. My father was this very well-known surgeon, so we were lucky. We were privileged. Though my country is a third world country, we were living a very comfortable lifestyle. Things had gotten really bad right before we left, from what I know now. When I was 5 years old, I remember my father coming into class and pulling me out of school and letting me know we were leaving Bolivia to come to the States that day. My mom tried to excite me and say, "You're going to see Disneyland." It was their way of letting me know this is the dream. This is the American dream. I guess the best way to describe it is Disneyland.
Hey, everybody, let's go!
Welcome to the United States. Your immigration status may be subject to...
It's a culture shock. You go from a country where everyone knows your name, you have colleagues, to a country where your degree does not matter, can't speak the language. 5 of us were sleeping in a little room. It's changed their lives completely. To have anything, you have to start from scratch.
This is Vicky's mom. She's pretty much adapted to life in LA.
I'm okay because I have in here my children's, and my husband, and my mom, and my brothers, you know, sisters, niece, everything. Everybody's here. What do you think, you know?
But Vicky's dad has a different tale. This is him playing the guitar and singing.
Because Because my dad arrived here and didn't speak the language, it was very hard for him to pass the test to be able to practice medicine in the States. And we didn't have money for him to keep trying. And he loved his profession so much. He just volunteered hours and hours and hours to a hospital. And everyone knew him as the doctor, though he was not a doctor here. For me, I can see that the language was something that really stressed my parents, so I couldn't wait till I would get home one day and say, I learned English. I thought it would be like, I can leave, go to school one day and come back and say, Mom, guess what? Today I learned English. I ran for student council in fifth grade, and I won. And every morning when we did our salute to the flag, the pledge, and I had to be the one guiding the school through it, it felt like English was no longer my second language. It felt like it was my language. Holly, Holly, Hollywood. That's my neighborhood. I grew up in Hollywood, core years. That was my first job at Carl's Jr. Manager was super mean. I used to work crazy hours. I don't think it's legal for minors to work past midnight. I used to work till 2 a.m. And the bus used to pick me up from here. I used to get bused to school like a nerd. My magnet was law and government.
Your magnet high school?
Yeah. I worked in the Superior Court as an intern. I wanted to be a lawyer so badly. I didn't know what kind of lawyer, but...
Vicky's no stranger to the legal system. She's been going to court since grade school.
I had to dress up in little suits that my mom would buy so that I make it to court. I had to go and translate for my parents.
When they were in Bolivia, Vicky's dad lost his job as chief of medicine at a government hospital because he was in the wrong political party when a regime change occurred. So, upon entering the States, the whole family applies for political asylum.
So much time went by from elementary to middle school to high school, going from appeal after appeal after appeal.
While Vicky's family is in limbo, they see that all their cousins and aunts and uncles are getting in through other more common routes, like marriage and sponsorship.
We've always been taught to do everything the legal way.
Vicky's family changes their plan of action. Her brother is an architect. He applies as a skilled worker, and he gets approved. Vicky and her parents apply for immediate family sponsorship. They get approved. And then literally a few days later, they get the news that their political asylum case that's still open from years ago is officially denied. And one is about to cancel out the other. In the middle of the night, they get a knock on the door.
At about 4 a.m. in the morning, someone was knocking at our door, and when we opened the door, it was 12 officers from immigration with guns forcing themselves into our apartment. They had orders to handcuff us and take us right then and there. We were quote-unquote illegal.
They are able to mount one last appeal.
We recently, about a year ago, were denied.
A final, final, final denial. But they decide to stay. And this time, they're not just going to sit around and wait for ICE to come pick them up.
The first month where we got our denial, we had to hide. I changed all my addresses from my bank to a P.O. box. Our style of living was that of fear because we were afraid someone would show up to our house.
They abandon their Hollywood apartment and they move to this special house. in an undisclosed location.
Always looking out to see who would be out there, being cautious.
A house with a security system, a guard dog, surrounded by a massive iron fence with spiked posts and triple locks.
A safe place.
So what's this gate like? Can you describe it?
You know, it's two-story high gate that just kept us secured from what might happen to us.
So we lock when we come in, we lock when we go out, and there's no buzzer to even get in.
No, not at all. If we have any guests, they just call us to the cell phone and we come and open the door. And we're secure this way. We just had to change our way of thinking and our way of living for the most part. After a few months, my brother and I were like, we can't live this way. We are not criminals. We're not running away because we killed someone. We should not be hiding. This is not healthy. I don't want to get sick over this anymore. I do not want my parents to get sick over it anymore.
Now, for the first time since Vicky came to the States as a kid, she has to lie low. She's totally blacklisted from receiving any financial aid for school because of her current immigration status, and so she can't become a lawyer. Everything is on hold.
I can't plan years ahead because I don't know where I will be. So I kind of learned to live my life from a day-to-day basis, and maybe that's what helps me be more relaxed and enjoy my years of being 23, 24, and a little bit of stress-free. I have to tease my hair and pick it up in a ponytail. I love your feather. So Sex and the City.
It's your feather.
Yeah, but it's your feather tonight. Many of us see the States and have the States as our country. I can't imagine myself going to Bolivia and saying this is my home. It'd be like someone took me away from home. Here, this is my home.
Thank you, Vicky Crooks, for sharing your story with us. And just so you all know, Vicky Crooks is not her real name. It's the one she chose to use for this story, inspired by her favorite rapper, Tupac, whose birth name was Lassane Parrish Crooks. Vicky's situation is a common one. There was a bill introduced into Congress called the DREAM Act that would grant amnesty to people from foreign countries who were brought here as young children. Check it out. Now then, we are exploring that impulse to go back, to go back, to go back home from whence we came, or maybe from where our people came. Those historical trails, though, sometimes they can be very, very dark roads.
The story is from writer Michael Pearl, who took a European road trip in 2006.
I wanted to go to Poland and retrace my heritage. My grandfather came from Poland and had to leave in 1939 when he was put in Bergen-Belsen Stalag, which was also where Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was. That's the one where Anne Frank died. He actually got typhus from that same outbreak of typhus that killed her. I knew the name of his town where he had grown up. And that was really it. I knew the name of the town, and I had a picture of him there. And I decided that with this, I was going to go to Poland, and I was going to have some kind of everything is illuminated experience.
So he goes to the Jewish Historical Institute, where he tells a woman there about where he wants to go.
In the city of Rachonj.
She tells him about the landmarks he needs to see there. The Catholic Cathedral. A row of old Jewish houses.
You know there's a Jewish cemetery, she tells me. I didn't. And my great-grandparents and probably great-great-grandparents must be buried in that place. She had pictures that were 20 years old, where some panzer division had rolled over it. Because the Nazis, efficient as they were, would still take a detour to be assholes and roll over a graveyard with their tanks. Do I want to see that? Hell yeah, I want to see that. And eventually I find a long-range taxi service that will take me to this town. And then this really friendly woman who works at the hostel where I'm staying says, here's your driver, this is your driver. His name is Joshka Mishkas. I go with this guy who doesn't speak any English, whose name I don't know. And we set off on the 3-hour road trip. We finally get to this town. I can see dead ahead of us the cathedral. I have in my hand a picture of my grandfather standing in front of that cathedral in 1934. And it's 2006 now. And so I put my camera on the hood of the car and I get a nice picture of me in front of that too. So we get back in the car and we drive like 1 mile. It's a pretty small town. And all these Jewish homes, all of them have been converted into like a flower shop, a newsstand, a stand that sells like fans and spark plugs and things like that. You know, he's like, points, we're at the Jewish homes, get out, look, go. And so I get out and I take a bunch of pictures and I'm thinking like, what am I doing? There are all of these Polish people who 5 minutes ago were enjoying their Saturday afternoon. And now here's this character who's just showed up, who doesn't speak Polish. We don't know what's going on. We haven't seen somebody from outside our town in 2 weeks. And the driver's going around to all these people saying God knows what. Like, here's a Jew, and he wants to see the Jew stuff. And what's happening? And tell me about what happened with Jews in this city and all that. And he finally gets the attention of this, like, 90-year-old lady who just talks his ear off. She's pointing to the house. She's telling a story. And she's pointing to the cathedral, and she's telling more stories, and she's pointing to the synagogue. Oh, there was a synagogue right across the street that was now a high school. She's pointing to the synagogue. She's got more stories. You know? So, I mean, my mouth is watering for the information that he's getting from this old lady, and he's totally incapable of translating. I'm not getting a lick of it. Crowds start forming around me. People start glaring at me. Oh, he's looking at the Jewish stuff. I suddenly feel very self-conscious, and from the looks I'm getting, threatened. They don't want me there.
That girl Olga who worked at the hostel
at one point sat me down
and said, look, this item on your list where you want to sit down with somebody and talk to them about the Holocaust, I don't think you should do this.
And people are kind of staring me down, so it's time to go. We drive sort of a little outside of the city to the outskirts. We have to steer off the road onto this like real bumpy stone path in the middle of this field. And as we're driving through the middle of this field, we see there's this person who we're about to ask for directions is just like scooping mountains of trash. Stuff that he can burn here, stuff that he can't burn here. And so the driver looks like he knows where we're going. And at one point, we get to this wind in the road and the driver stops, waves his finger around like around here somewhere. He and I both get out of the car, and we both look at each other momentarily like, you know, pardon me for a minute, but we both get the same idea. Yeah, we both have to take a leak. And I'm noticing as I go, my feet are sinking into this mossy ground that I'm walking on. 8 inches with every step that I take. And he comes up to me and he looks at me like, does any of this make sense to you? You know, does this seem at all like what you were expecting? And I give him a look like, I don't know where there's a cemetery around here. All I see is woods. And as I walk further, my legs literally fall right into the ground through grass clippings and dead leaves until I'm up to my thighs in the ground. Every time I take a step, I'm in a clearing, you know? And the driver's looking, and he feels the way you feel. This is pretty strange. And he gets out his phone, and he calls this number. After he speaks Polish for a second, he hands me the phone. It's the woman from the hostel. He has told her what he thinks is going on. She says, the driver doesn't think you're going to find the cemetery. And I said, did he say that he thinks that we're standing on what used to be a pile of trash, and before that was a cemetery? And she said, yeah, that's basically what he said. And I said, yeah, that's what I think too. And she said, so you're coming back? And I said, yeah, I think I'm coming back.
Many thanks to Snap Judgment Stephanie Fu for bringing us that story. Michael Pearl is a writer living in Los Angeles, but you do not have to be a writer living anywhere. If you have a story you'd like to share, let us know. Snapjudgment.org. Any way you want to tell it, text, video, pictures. We got this amazing multimedia website. Leave your story and listen to others. Podcasts, pictures, movies. The everything that we are is at snapjudgment.org, including the new Snap Judgment iPhone application. What? You don't have an iPhone? No matter. We've got the mobile website, baby. You are welcome. Snap Judgment loves you. Keep it locked. We'll be right back after the break.
Snap Judgment is here for you, keeping it real and putting the public back in public radio. And all we ask in return is for your feedback. So feel free as you can be, to write an iTunes review. We would love that. And of course, if you have yet to hear Snap Judgment, the radio show on your local public radio station where it belongs, the power is in your very own hands. All you have to do is call up your local public radio station and request the show, Snap Judgment. It's that easy. And thanks for listening. Snap Judgment is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment. Today, stories about people who cannot go home. And one reason people have traditionally avoided returning to their homes was because the military was bombing it. Now, you've heard or known, maybe you even were one of the persons who experienced the fall of Saigon. We're proud to bring you this story because, well, some stories just speak for themselves.
When most people think about the fall of Saigon, they think about the iconic image of helicopters taking off from the U.S. Embassy. Well, that was Plan B. Plan A was to get everybody out through Thon Son Nhut Airport.
Vietnam Airport, Thon Son Nhut.
Thon Son Nhut Airport was the base of all air operations for all of South Vietnam. From there, the Americans and the South Vietnamese Air Force would coordinate their attacks on the VC. It was also the place where, at the age of 20, Diane took a job with a little-known airline called Air America.
Air America, known as the CIA, but I don't know. I work for that warehouse, so I didn't know anything going on.
So you were working for the CIA, but you didn't know it.
Yeah.
So once Diane gets her foot in the door, then she gets her brother a job.
My older brother worked for CIA.
He did.
I didn't know, he didn't tell me. They hired him as investigator, interpreter. Every time they catch those DC, you know, North Vietnam soldier, and they question them, and my brother had to be there and translate. And he didn't tell me.
Now at that time, it wasn't just war that was going on. It was also the intermingling between the Vietnamese people and the American soldiers. And Diane found herself the object of attention of a GI named Billy.
Yeah, he was in the army. That's how I met him. They just stood around there because we go to work very early, 7 o'clock in the morning. Watch us walk by and they're whistling. You know, you see the movies, same thing, you know.
Now, even though she's only 20 years old, Diane has already been married one time. She has two children. One, a older daughter who's disabled, and a younger son. Well, this does not dissuade Billy at all. So Diane caves in and decides to give him a chance.
What I learned is when you marry a GI and you have to go anywhere he go that the country send him to. I know, I believe that when you marry somebody and he go anywhere, you go with him.
Sometimes when the army sends you somewhere, they don't necessarily let you bring your family. So Diane says to Billy, look, I want you to get discharged. And he does it. Then, they have a child of their own. And after a while, they decide, maybe it's time to leave Vietnam.
1972, my husband and I decided to come back all the way to Mississippi. That's when Finnish father...
Your husband is from Mississippi.
From Mississippi. How you call it? Lambert?
Lambert?
Yeah.
Lambert? I've never heard of it, but...
Outside.
Small place.
Very small. I said, I like to stay in San Francisco. I don't like Mississippi.
You don't like Mississippi?
Yeah.
How come?
It's so country. I'm a city girl. So we went to Mississippi. I said, oh my God. That's Mississippi. I have to go to the toilet outside.
You're not used to that being out.
No.
Now, to its credit, Lambert, Mississippi is the home of Snooky Pryor, one of the original blues harmonica players, learned to cup it like that, played through a PA, very innovative. But that's not enough to keep Diana Lambert. She says, I want to move to San Francisco. They move to San Francisco, and she gets pregnant.
At that time, accidentally, I'm pregnant. And then I start getting sick, and then I start missing the food in Vietnam. So I was suffering, you know, cannot eat, and then I just start getting, I want to go back. That's why we went back.
So that's interesting. Didn't anything cross your mind? Why am I going back there at this time when everyone is leaving Vietnam?
I didn't know that time is not. They was talking about ceasefire peace. So I thought, safe.
You thought it was safe to go back?
Yes.
So, Billy and Diane go back to Vietnam to have their baby, Jeannie. Now, there was a ceasefire agreement, but by 1974, the North Vietnamese have violated that. And by 1975, Saigon is about ready to fall, and Billy is out of the country.
So, we hear the bombing every night. Bombing, you know? Bomb, bomb, bomb. So that's why I'm starting getting so... worry, I'm scared. So, and also all this rumor was talking about the North Vietnam people, they hate America.
You can get killed here. Get out while you are still alive and before it's too late.
In the middle of the night, she gets a pounding on the gate. It's 12 South Vietnamese soldiers with guns. They're saying, open up or we're going to shoot.
We all lie down on the floor. I try to reach the phone, bring the phone down, and call embassy, military police. Takes forever to get there.
Why did they want you to open the door?
Rob.
They wanted to rob you.
So they know there's American people who live in this house. You remind me this part. Oh, it's so scary, I tell you.
The U.S. Army is already evacuated. You don't know whose side the South Vietnamese is on. Diane says, I can't afford to wait for Billy. I've got to get out of here now.
I can't wait for him to come back and get us. We might get stuck or something might happen. So I say, no, I have to find a way to leave.
Just because she has a green card and her kids have passports doesn't mean she can get out because the whole town is on lockdown.
It's curfew. How can I go to the airport? How can I purchase a ticket to go, to leave? There's no way.
The city was suddenly choked with people, lorries, and cars, all chasing one American evacuation convoy after the other. Jams that the Vietnamese police tried to clear with their rifles, but people were no longer afraid of them. There was now
a lot of these Americans live next to each other, and around the corner is a guy named Jim, and he's with transportation. Now Jim, it turns out, is really good friends with Jack Daniels.
I bought 2 bottles of whiskey over. I said, Jim, please help. You know, I really need to get out. So, times go by day by day, day by day. So the last day, I say, Jim, that's all the whiskey I have. Because either you help me, you don't help me, I'm not going, you know, I have nothing to bring to you anymore. Just a couple of days later, he called. He called, he said, get ready. So he said, okay.
So Jim shows up with the embassy car. Diane's there with her 3 daughters, but she also has 1 son, 13 years old. The South Vietnamese say, we need him to fight. And Jim, he doesn't want to fight that fight.
So I say, I'm not leaving without him. I got to bring him, he's my son.
Jim knows he doesn't have the clout to drive a 13-year-old boy past the South Vietnamese soldiers. So he says, all right, Everybody, line up in the back seat, and we'll hide the kid under your skirts.
So we really cover him. They can't see. Unless they open the door, they can see him. But they didn't open the door. Lucky. Right?
Yes, very lucky.
Very lucky. Oh, my God.
So she gets her four kids to Tanzania Airport, and everything should be free and clear. But it turns out it's not clear, and it's certainly not free.
There's a table. They register you.
Yes.
Okay? You don't get registered, you cannot get on the plane.
Yes.
They try to get...
They what?
Money.
Oh.
Outside the American embassy, the wise, the wealthy, and those with any known American connections had been queuing night and day, demanding, pleading for a visa and a ticket for a seat on the United States evacuation planes flying out of Tonsonut Airport.
Because I thought I knew them, I knew some of them, I thought I can, you know, register. But I ran into one guy, he's American, and we used to have a dinner and drink together and party together. He don't talk to me. He pretend he don't know me.
He acts like he never met you.
And you believe that. So I knew no point to find any one of them to talk to them, to get on the plane. I knew I have no hope. And somebody told me, you need to pay $2,000 per person to get to register, to get on the plane.
$2,000?
U.S. dollar. At that time, it's a lot of money.
$2,000 per person. What are
That's
you...
That's why I'm afraid I get killed. If I tell you, you go in the air. So I said, oh my God, where I got money? What am I going to do? And this girl was so sick. And her face all red, her lips all red. I carried her until I'm so tired. And then I can't stand anymore. I sit on the floor.
She's sitting there, surrounded by her four kids, youngest with measles, her oldest disabled. And then she sees a shadow.
And one of the young pilot, you know, he came. Can I do anything for you? I say, yes, please carry my baby for me because she's sick. I'm so tired. My arm almost break, you know. And he said, what else I can do for you? Tell me what else I can do. He's so young and he's very nice and kind. I say, I told him the truth. I say, look, I marry American. I have a green card. My children have American passport. They don't allow me to register. They want me to pay $2,000 per person. Where I got the money?
And what did he say?
How I'm going? He said, okay, now you carry your baby. Carry your baby. I go find my boss. He came and I tell him the story. He told me.
What?
So he told me, stay right here. I'm going to call your name. Pretend my name on the list. I stay right there. He said, all your children stay right here. So when they start calling name to go to the aircraft, he says, go. Tell me to go.
He called your name.
Yeah. He asked me my name and he put on the list for me. The list he called. They give it to him, but without my name. But he put my name on the list. And then he called me.
Well, what did you think at that time?
I'm so grateful. I say, oh my God, there's still a lot of good people in the earth. I wish I can remember his name. I tell him, thank. Without him, put us on the plane, we won't be here today.
So when he let you on the plane, did he go on the plane with you?
Yeah,
did he take care of you all the way?
He went on the plane. He helped my daughter in the plane, the disabled one.
Yes.
And in the plane, we don't have a chair. All sat on the floor. Got this gun? Give me what?
Ammunition.
All on the floor, curling up like that. So we have to pass the Vietnamese authority, and then they warn us: don't let your baby cry. Be quiet. And no talking.
How did you keep her quiet? Okay.
So I got some ice pad, put ice on her. Try to keep
the fever down.
Yes.
Right when you're taking off.
Yeah.
Taking off.
That was scary.
Are there any people shooting? What's happening?
Lucky nobody shoot.
And so tell me how you felt when you got up in the air.
What I released.
Take me back to the last time you saw the man that helped you.
The moment we landed, all the press was waiting. We're the first plane or second plane, I don't know. But the press was waiting. He is the one carrying my disabled daughter to first one to walk down, walk out the aircraft. And they took the picture. It was on the newspaper.
Okay, so here's the question. Have you been back to Vietnam?
No. Yes. Oh, yeah, last year. November. I don't want to come back.
You don't want to go back there?
Yeah.
She didn't want to go to begin with.
Yeah, it's everything changed, not the same. And I just don't like it now.
Whatever happened to your brother? The guy who worked for Air America.
Finally, he said, I can't stay here anymore. Why don't you sponsor me? I want to go to America. So I did. I sponsored him, get him out of Vietnam. Now he's leaving.
All right. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Yeah, the children didn't know that I have a hard time to take them out, you know. And sometimes they just... So that's your duty.
The communist flag flew over a Saigon renamed to honor the man whose prophecies had led them here and who had died before he saw them come true. They called it Ho Chi Minh City.
Diane's story was produced by Mark Ristich and brought to us by her daughter Jeannie, the very same Jeannie whom she carried in her arms all the way from Saigon. Snap Judgment was produced by myself, but never alone. There would be no Snap without the uber producer, Mark Ristich, the god of war and radio, Roman Mars. Don't quite have a handle on how to get your sway on with 7-inch stiletto heels? Too bad you're not Rebecca Megahertz. The amazing Snap Judgment production team, Mo Steph, Stephanie Fu, Rita Samba Daniels. He likes the Muslims, the Jews, the Buddhists, the Jains, but his name is Christian Pollock. Tinker, Taylor, Soldier, Spy, Will Urbina. DJ Ben Smooth Grooves Percasio. Now, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting likes to sometimes hang in the back of the club, looking at its drink, wishing for someone to ask them to dance. You ask them to dance. Tell them that Snap said they can really shake it. Many thanks. Youth Speaks, because the next generation can speak for itself, putting the public in public media, PRX, and while this is certainly not the new, in fact, you could pick your favorite squad of soccer hooligans, run around kicking everybody's ass, get locked up, deported, end up on the streets of Denver mumbling about Manchester United, while people hurry by wondering what happened to you, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR. The producer of this very podcast, listening, judging, and condemning all she hears out of my mouth right now, is Snap Judgment's own podcast producer, Rita Daniels.